virtually every hour. Jamie would go outside in his sky blue hard suit to take rock and soil samples and plant an automated meteorology geology beacon that would measure air temperature and pressure, humidity, wind velocity, and record heat flow coming up from underground, as well as any seismic activity. The beacon sent its signal to the pair of spacecraft hovering in synchronous orbit some 20,000 kilometers above the equator. The communications equipment aboard the spacecraft automatically relayed the signals both to their base camp and back to Earth. Despite the rover's pressurized interior, both Jamie and Voznesensky found themselves living inside their hard suits. The Russian went strictly by the mission rules that said he had to be suited up whenever Jamie went outside in case an emergency arose. More often than not, the cosmonaut came out with Jamie. At first, he busied himself with inspecting the rover's exterior, the wheels, the antennas, the way the iron-rich Martian sand powdered the finish of the rover's skin. By the second morning, though, it seemed to Jamie that Voznesensky came outside merely to have some human company and to enjoy the scenery.
"You say your New Mexico looks like this?"
the Russian asked. Jamie heard his voice in his helmet earphones. Bent stiffly over a waist-deep gully that exposed a seam of basaltic rock, he said,
"Yep, cliffs and arroyos, canyons, clear skies, not much rain. It must be very barren, then."
Smiling to himself, Jamie replied,
"Compared to this, it's the Garden of Eden."
The Russian fell silent. Jamie straightened up and took the video camera from his belt. The gully ran all the way out to the horizon, almost as straight as train tracks, except for some slumping here and there where the ground had slid down to partially fill it in. A fault line, Jamie recognized. The area's crisscrossed with them. But this one's been eroded by running water. Had to be. Or mass wasting, permafrost melting beneath the surface and undermining everything. But when? There's been no liquid water around here for hundreds of millions of years, most likely. Could a rill remain unchanged all that time? He returned the camcorder to its clip on his belt and went to work chipping at the exposed rock ledge. Then he put the samples into a pouch and picked up the drill. As usual, the drill bit into the ground easily for the first meter or so, then hit resistance. Permafrost, thought Jamie. This whole region is sitting on top of a frozen ocean just a few feet below the surface. Once he had pulled the core sample from the drill bit and carefully deposited it in a sample case, he started back toward the rover. Voznesensky was standing there, watching in his fire engine red hard suit.
"Okay,"
Jamie said.
"I'm finished here. All I've got to do is..."
He realized that the Russian had already taken one of his sensor beacons from the equipment bay in the rover's middle section. Jamie took it from him.
"Thanks, Mikhail."
He could sense the man's shrug.
"I had nothing better to do. Thanks,"
Jamie repeated. Minutes later, they were back in the rover's cockpit, Voznesensky in the left seat. They had both removed their helmets and gloves. Their hard suits bulked in the cockpit's bucket seats like a pair of brightly colored, armor-plated polar bears. Voznesensky steered between a boulder the size of a small house and a shallow circular depression that looked to Jamie like the weathered fossil of an ancient meteor crater. The Russian had small, almost delicate hands, Jamie noticed. He maneuvered the tiny steering wheel with nothing more than a fingertip's pressure. "We should reach the canyons today," he said, "if we do not have to make more stops." Jamie took the hint. "We'll stop only to fill in the net of beacons. Of course, if there's some important change in the landforms..." Voznesensky smiled slightly without turning his eyes away from his driving. "Of course." Jamie tried to settle back and get comfortable, but the hard shell of the pressure suit was not meant to sit in. The damned armpit was still chafing despite the padding he had packed into it. He watched the landscape unrolling as they drove slowly toward the strangely close horizon. It bothered him, seeing the horizon so near. Almost frightened him down at the subliminal level where nightmares take root. Jamie felt as if they were driving toward the edge of a cliff. "The horizon looks awfully close, doesn't it?" he said to Voznesensky. The Russian bobbed his head once. "The smaller the planet, the shorter the horizon. It is even closer on the moon."
"I've never been to the moon."
"Much closer than here, and much more barren." DiNardo had been on the moon, Jamie knew. I was called in so suddenly I never got farther off the Earth than the space stations until we started out for Mars. He forced his attention away from the too close horizon and concentrated on the land they were driving through. To anyone but a geologist, the scenery would have looked dull, monotonous, barren. But Jamie's mind was leaping from rock to fault crack, crater to sand dune, trying to puzzle out the forces that had shaped this land, sculpted it into its present form. "I have flown over New Mexico," Osnesensky said, almost as if to himself, "in the Mir 3 space station while training for this mission." "Then you saw how much it looks like Mars." "I did not realize it at the time. I did not pay sufficient attention." Jamie studied the Russian's face. He was dead serious, as always, somber, grim. "Did you always want to be a cosmonaut?" Jamie asked suddenly. "Ever since you were a little child?" Voznesensky swiveled his head toward Jamie for an instant, then immediately turned back to look ahead. The expression on his face, fleetingly, was almost angry. "I shouldn't have asked," Jamie thought. "He resents my prying into his personal history." But the Russian muttered, "When I was very little, before starting school even, I wanted to be a cosmonaut. To me, it meant everything. Gagarin was my hero. I wanted to be like him. The first man in space." Voznesensky nodded again, another single curt bob of his head. "Gagarin was first in orbit. Armstrong was first on the moon. I told myself I would be first on Mars." "And you were?" "Yes." "You must feel very proud about it." The cosmonaut glanced at Jamie again. "Proud, yes. Maybe even happy. But that moment has passed. Now I feel the responsibility. I am in charge. I am responsible for all your lives."
"I see."
"Do you? You are a scientist. You are happy to be here, to explore. You have a new world to play with. I am the man of authority. I am the one who must say no to you when you want to go too far, when you might endanger yourself or the others."
"We all understand that," Jamie said. "We accept it."
"Yes? Does Dr. Molitor accept it?" "She hates me. She goes out of her way to annoy me every chance she gets."
"Ilona isn't..." Jamie's voice trailed off. He realized he had no defense for her.
"She is a Jewish bitch who hates old Russians. I know that. She has made it very clear to me."
"Her grandparents fled Hungary."
"So? Was that my fault? Am I to be blamed for things that happened in our grandparents' day? She risks the success of this mission because of a grudge that is two generations old?"
Jamie laughed softly. "Mikhail, I know people who have kept grudges going for two centuries, not just two generations."
The Russian said nothing.
"There are American Indians who are still fighting battles from colonial times."
"The Yankee imperialists took your land from you," Voznesensky said. "They engaged in genocide against your people. We learned this in school."
"That happened a long time ago, Mikhail," said Jamie. "Should I spend my life hating all the whites? Should I hate my mother because she's descended from people who killed my ancestors? Should Pete Connors hate Paul Abel because his ancestors were slaves and Paul's were slave owners?"
"You feel no bitterness at all?"
The question stopped Jamie. He did not truly know what he felt. He had hardly ever considered a matter in such a light. Was Grandfather Al bitter? No, he seemed to accept the world as he found it. "Use what's at hand, Jamie," Al would say. "When they hand you a lemon, make lemonade. Use what's at hand and make the best of what you find." At length, Jamie answered. "Mikhail, my parents are both university professors. I was born in New Mexico and went back there to spend summer vacations when I was a kid, but I grew up in Berkeley, California."
"A hotbed of radicalism."
Voznesensky said it flatly, as if reciting a memorized line. Jamie could not tell if the Russian were joking or serious. "My father has spent most of his life trying not to be an Indian, although he'd never admit it. Probably doesn't even realize it. He earned a scholarship to Harvard University. He married a woman who's descended from the original Mayflower colonists. Neither one of them wanted me to be an Indian.